Hello, this is Zsófilter, the feminist podcast of Partizan, an independent media channel in Hungary. My name is Zsófi Balog, and my guest today is Robert Wintermute, who has been a professor of human rights law at King's College London since 2003. Robert is an expert on discrimination based on sexual orientation with nearly 40 years of academic and practical experience. He was the first openly gay lawyer at the Milbank Law Firm in New York at a time when there was no law prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation. Since 2000, he has participated in LGBT equality cases in the European Court of Human Rights. Robert is also one of the original 29 signatories of the Yogyakarta Principles, which he later came to criticize because of the impact it had on women's rights. He has since then become a trustee of LGBT Alliance, the British organization for homosexual people who no longer feel represented by the current mainstream LGBTQ movement. Our international listeners, welcome to Partizan's podcast channel. You can find out more about us on our YouTube and social media platforms. And if you can, please support our work through our Patreon. Robert, good to have you in Budapest.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you for talking to me. We are at the International Conference on Marriage Equality in the Central European University, organized by the Foundation for Rainbow Families, Szivárvány Családokért Alapítvány, and you just gave your presentation comparing European human rights standards with Hungary's legal framework with regards to issues like same-sex marriage, second parent adoption, donor insemination access, etc. And while I was listening to you speak, it just hit me that, wow, there are actually people who do this, apparently for decades. They argue in courts in serious places about, for instance, you know, that is okay. It is okay to hold hands as characters in a book in Lithuania, because you mentioned the case,
yes,
a case there that was about a fairy tale book, and apparently the government thought it was too explicit.
Explicit, yeah.
And you had to argue that actually, well, it is all about holding hands and hugging. Mm-hmm. So, has it become normal for you to argue in front of judges about, you know, completely normal things that should be normal? Why can't two people who are adults get married with the same rights and all that? So how do you feel about that? Has it become easier, harder? Or?
I suppose having a lot of experience helps me to take a long view on it, because I can always look back to the point when I started and how much worse things were. So when I started, I was at the Milbank Law Firm in New York when I first did some work on cases related to LGBT rights. They still had criminal laws in the U.S. and they were upheld, prohibiting same-sex sexual activity. They were upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1986. And at that time, you didn't have any country in the world with a law allowing a same-sex couple to register their relationship, not as registered partnership, civil union, nothing. Denmark was the first in 1989. So in the 1990s, when I first started studying the European Convention on Human Rights, there was a strong argument that a majority of countries had an equal age of consent in the criminal law. So what a lot of European countries had done is they would legalize sexual activity between men, but they would set a higher age of consent to stigmatize it, to protect vulnerable younger men, etc. So, for example, in England and Wales, it was 21 versus 16. So there was this strong argument that the majority of countries do not do this, it's only a minority. And at that time, I said, okay, this is great, this is a good argument, but what about everything else? And this was around 1997 at a conference in Paris. You had all the countries of Eastern Europe joining the Council of Europe and the European Convention on Human Rights. And I realized, this is going to take a long time. Because if we have to get to a majority on all these other issues, it's going to be slow. So I wrote this book chapter in 2001, Strasbourg to the Rescue, referring to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg in Eastern France, same-sex partners and parents under the European Convention. So are they going to come to the rescue? Well, not as quickly as we would like, but slowly. Already in 2003, in a case, Karner versus Austria, they decided that same-sex couples must have the same rights as unmarried opposite-sex couples. And in some countries, that's a lot. In some countries, it's nothing. So, and then they've gradually built on that. They extended that to second parent adoption in Austria because unmarried opposite sex couples had it. That's 2013. And then 2015, you get the Oliari versus Italy case saying Italy had to have a specific legal framework for same-sex couples. The prime minister at the time was very keen to comply with the judgment. And within 10 months, they passed a law on civil unions for same-sex couples. So I suppose I've always focused on the smaller steps that you can ask the court to take and remained patient, knowing for bigger steps, we'll, like marriage, we have to wait.
Yeah, in the presentation also, I realized that, of course, I mean, these kind of cases, maybe they at the time seem like a small step or like, I guess, when they are still ongoing, you just don't know the outcome. But then they could be cited or they could be referred to as some kind of precedent and some kind of case that you can build others on. And so they do have a big impact, of course. But these have been big sweeping changes over the decades. That's really astonishing to look at this in a historic perspective. But for us, it seems like, you know, we'll never get there. I mean, the government is getting more and more conservative, more and more openly anti-gay. But then, as you said, if the majority of the countries in the Council of Europe allow same-sex marriage on the national level, if I understand it correctly, then Strasbourg can come to the rescue,
yes, eventually.
And I actually didn't know that Hungary is one of the countries who has the oldest registered partnership laws, along with the Czech Republic and Cyprus.
Well, actually, I could just comment on that. A bit of historical luck, I would say, for Hungary was that the registered partnership law was introduced in 2009, 1 year before the Orbán government. So
right.
If that had not happened, Hungary would be in the same position as Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, Slovakia, etc. So, that's a bit of luck. You have to count your blessings.
Yes.
But, just going back to the small steps, 25 years ago, the issue was child custody. So you had a case against Portugal where a gay father had a child with a woman, his wife, and they separated and divorced, and eventually he was denied custody of his daughter because of his sexual orientation. So the Portuguese family court said it openly, and the European Court of Human Rights said that's discrimination. You cannot take sexual orientation into account as a negative factor in a child custody decision. So that was step one, just getting custody of your own genetic child. Step two was, okay, how about adopting as an individual? You're not a parent yet, but why should your sexual orientation be held against you? And that took two cases in 2002, Philippe Frette versus France. The earlier case was Mota versus Portugal. Frette versus France, we lost by 4-3 in 2002. So Philippe Frette, an openly gay man, applied to adopt a child as an individual. His application was rejected. And he lost by 4-3 in the European Court of Human Rights. But in 2008, a lesbian woman won her case, EB versus France. And that established the principle that if an individual is allowed to adopt a child, then lesbian and gay applicants must be eligible, which is what you're seeing in some of the Hungarian court. Public official will say they're not eligible to adopt, and the courts will overrule the decision. And the head of the family foundation he and his partner have two children through adoption, despite all the obstacles in the Hungarian system. So
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible that you still have to argue this, even honestly, even in a under conservative government, because we also have just an understanding of, you know, non-discrimination generally. I think the average person in Hungary just has a general attitude that, of course, adopting a child or caring for a child, it should not matter what kind of sexual orientation you have. Of course, I'm generalizing, but it's just really strange how the government could turn this narrative and really pump it up over the past few years against sexual minorities. One thing I wanted to ask about, again, just staying with the historic record, because I'm really curious. So you mentioned that, you know, these laws were mainly against homosexual men, or I don't know if they were explicit in the law or they were just applied to men. But I'm really curious about how, you know, lesbians or cases of lesbians appear in the courts over time, or were they always like kind of equally represented in the courts, or and men just got more attention because it, you know, it was more outrageous for the general population, or I don't know. I'm really curious about this.
Just before I answer that question, I just wanted to say something about public opinion. So it gradually changes and improves over time, and it can take the law time to catch up with public opinion. So I experienced, or I saw this in Spain. They had a conservative government from 1996 to 2004. They were desperate. They couldn't see any hope of same-sex marriage and adoption. 2004, new government. 2005, same-sex marriage and adoption. So I think from what I'm hearing about public opinion, the public is almost ready in Hungary for these legal reforms, but it will probably take a change of government to for them to be brought in. Now, the criminalization of sexual activity between women depends on the country. If you think of heterosexual men in parliament, they're not, don't feel so threatened by sexual activity between women. In fact, they think it's exciting. They imagine themselves jumping in the middle. So on the whole, it hasn't been criminalized in Europe, with a few exceptions. Whereas in the US, they were very thorough. And what their criminal law did was criminalize all sexual activity except vaginal intercourse between husband and wife. So
wow.
Anything else was prohibited. So that included sexual activity between women. There was a study by the Human Dignity Trust in London of criminal laws about criminalization of sexual activity between women. I think they came up with over 40 countries in around the world that still do it. So,
wow, this is really, I mean, I'm just not familiar with the legal proceedings in detail, and it's just so astonishing to hear this in detail. You know, like, these are actual sentences written down somewhere and they are applied in court. It's just crazy. And the other thing that is crazy is how you mentioned in the presentation also that you are actually, I mean, the general you are looking for cases to argue, to set precedent, or to have cases that will overturn or change legislation. So is it the case that countries like Hungary could actually just look for and come up with cases where there's discrimination to argue in the council, or how does it go?
Yes, I mean, you need some brave people to be willing. Brave in the sense, I've come across this actually before in Hungary, the case can be anonymous, so you can use your initials for the outside world, but your name and address goes to the Hungarian government mm-hmm. when your application is submitted. And I had heard in the past that I was deterring some people
right.
in Hungary. But if someone's willing to go forward, step one is you have to go to the Hungarian courts and try, and if you fail there, then you go to the European Court of Human Rights. But if you persist with your case, and it can take a long time, you can set a precedent that will benefit same-sex couples in Hungary and in many other countries. So I actually was involved in a case dealing with immigration against Italy, Roberto Tadeucci and Douglas McCall versus Italy. They originally contacted me back in 2003. They were living in New Zealand and planning to move back to Italy. One of them was a citizen of Italy, the other a citizen of New Zealand. And they wondered how they would get an immigration, a residence permit. In Italy, the only way to get it was to be married. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't get married in Italy. So they went to the Italian courts. They lost in 2009. I became their lawyer then, and we went to the European Court of Human Rights. It took almost 7 years because there was a big backlog of cases against Italy.
Wow.
Which slowed things down. But eventually we won in June 2016. And this established a precedent for all Council of Europe countries. So they had already solved their own immigration problem. In 2009, they moved to the Netherlands, mm-hmm. where their relationship was recognized. Eventually they got married there, mm-hmm. etc. Because it became illegal for the man from New Zealand to be living in Italy. But they pursued the case and helped other people. So I think that's the thing you have to bear in mind. It's not about just about your individual case.
Right.
It's about all the other people who could benefit.
Right. I also wanted to talk about the current trends of the, well, it was called gay rights movement, but now I find this very strange, especially in this conference. You know, we want to argue for same-sex rights, but at the same time, the past 5-10 years, you know, everything that involved homosexual advocacy has kind of washed into the LGBTQI movement, or it just transformed. I don't know how to frame this. But it's very strange to me, and I wonder what you think. How you can, you know, advocate for same-sex rights in a culture that really actively wants to deny biological sex or advocacy based on sex. Has it gotten more difficult to actually talk about one specific topic, like homosexuals and same-sex rights?
Well, I think we're coming to the question of LGBT and whether it makes sense to group the issue, to join the issues together.
Right.
Questions of sexual orientation and questions of gender identity. And to be honest, in the 1990s, when this first started to happen, I couldn't see what the two groups had in common. But I went along with it for many years because everyone else was doing it. And it was only really in about 2018 I started to question it. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, I think it was a mistake because the issues are very different and we need to be able to disagree with each other about some issues, particularly medical treatment of children and teenagers. And also, I think the LGBT rights generally don't affect other people, and there are stronger claims where there's some transgender demands do affect other people, especially women and children, and they need to be debated. So overall, my concern now is that the T in LGBT politically could be dragging down LGB. And I think Hungary might be an example of that. So if you look at the anti-promotion law from 2021, mm-hmm. it talks about gender identity questions first, and then homosexuality comes at the end of the list. So would the law have been passed if LGBT were not together? Hard to say, but I recently spoke to a Bulgarian activist where they recently passed an anti-promotion law in Bulgaria very quickly. He said what it was triggered it was some kind of advert with a drag queen, linking drag queen and children. So yeah, I think long-term it is going to make LGB rights more difficult in many countries if they're linked to certain transgender demands. So, if to support LGBT rights, you must believe that trans women are women, trans women should be in women's prisons, trans women should be in women's sports, trans children, as some people call them, need urgent medical treatment. If that's a package, then it's going to be very unattractive to a lot of people.
Yes, it's very interesting looking at this from Hungary, because from one side, the Orbán government always finds a target. It's an easy target, of course. You can ridicule it very easily from, you know, whatever happens in the Western world. They can just twist it around. Sometimes they don't even have to twist it around. They are just ridiculous on their own or absurd. Whatever these LGBTQ organizations are advocating for sometimes. And at the same time, we wholesale just adopted, like the progressives here, just adopted all the narratives of the Western LGBTQ movement. So yes, you do have to advocate for everything all at once. There's no nuance, there's no criticism allowed, because if you criticize, you are with Orbán, or you are, you know, helping him attack these minorities. Yeah, no room for disagreeing or having a middle ground or a third kind of thinking about this. And at the same time, we also do see that, you know, in countries like the UK, the waves are kind of turning. You know, there's the LGB Alliance, there's, you know, a lot of activists, a lot of feminists are putting out, like, there's so much material now that you can find, you can argue. But somehow here, these organizations still just kind of ignore all that. They say, no, there's nothing to see here. All we have to focus on is Orbán. So people who are critical of this movement, like feminists, for instance, like me, are kind of weirdly finding ourselves agreeing, you know, whatever Orbán is doing, resisting, for instance, the self-ID laws. And it's not because we are, you know, conservative and we hate ourselves, but because it's problematic. So I'm really curious, first of all, what made you turn and criticize or look back, or what was it that made you see that there are problems with this connecting of the two issues, trans issues and LGB issues?
I suppose it was 2018 is when a government consultation started for, at least for England and Wales, about self-identification, amending the Gender Recognition Act 2004. And that's, you could say, when the resistance really got going in the UK. So I became aware of that debate. I think gradually I had more contact with gender critical women and heard their side of the story. And I found myself agreeing with them. And in terms of the politics in the UK, we had an organization called Stonewall, right, founded in 1989 to work on LGB equality. And they did that until 2015. So after same-sex marriage, arguably they should have just wound up because they had no more work to do. That came into force in 2014. But instead, they decided to take on transgender issues, and they were campaigning for self-identification. So that's what led to the foundation of LGB Alliance. So, yeah, actually, what I suppose I can thank Pink News for changing my opinion, because I had been a subscriber and for many years to an electronic newsletter, daily newsletter. And in the beginning, it was an LGB publication, and that was the news, what the news was about. And then gradually, some days I'd notice that five or all six items would be transgender. And about issues where I had some concerns, and I just, at one point I thought, am I going crazy or is the world going crazy? And then October 2019, Pink News reported that LGB Alliance had found it. And they would describe LGB Alliance as an anti-trans hate group, but they sounded quite sensible to me. So I approached them. I met with them in February 2020.
I just love the fact that you found out about LGB Alliance from Pink News.
Yes.
That's just beautiful.
They brought us together. They were the matchmaker.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And in 2021, LGB Alliance was granted charitable status, or was registered as a charity, which meant it needed a board of trustees to supervise its activities. And then I agreed in May 2021 to become a trustee of LGB Alliance. And in June 2021, now this is a good illustration of solidarity between LGB and T. What it really means is transgender rights trump everything else, is the way I've put it in the past, and LGB must follow.
Right.
So what happened when this new LGB organization becomes a registered charity? A transgender rights organization called Mermaids goes to court and tries to have the decision reversed. So one charity, Mermaids, tried to have the charitable status of another taken away, which had never happened in the UK before. And the case took 2 years, and a huge amount of money was spent, probably over 300,000 euros on both sides for legal fees. And in the end, LGB Alliance was vindicated. It was obvious from the start that Mermaids did not have any standing, meaning legal basis to pursue the case, because they weren't affected by it. Disagreeing with LGB Alliance did not give them the right to bring this challenge.
What was their argument even? I talked about this in passing with Kate Harris in a previous interview, and I just thought, you know, how can you argue this seriously?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I'd have to go back and look at their arguments, but there were things like LGB Alliance has said nasty things about us on Twitter, and we might have to compete with them for donations from the public. Well, that's a ridiculous argument. All charities have to compete with each other. The charity tribunal found that a charity doesn't have a right not to be criticized. The comparison I made was between two charities in the UK that both have existed for many years, Stonewall and the Christian Institute. And they did disagree about lots of things, but neither one went to court to try and take away the charitable status of the other. Yeah, so that was just a demonstration that if you participate in this LGBT coalition, it means, I call it actually capital T, big T followed by small LGB. It's a more accurate depiction of the political reality. So whatever transgender says, LGB have to go along with it. And that's what LGB Alliance is all about. Just we distance ourselves from the transgender rights movement and say we're not the same. We agree about with most of your demands, but not all of them. And we reserve the right to question them. I realized, well, I tried to give a seminar at McGill University in Montreal in Canada, January 2023 at the Faculty of Law, and between 100 and 200 student demonstrators were there, and they managed to invade the seminar room and stop the seminar. The one thing they objected to was that I was associated with LGB Alliance, which they called an anti-trans hate group. And what I realized after that event was that they had it the wrong way around. So LGB Alliance does not promote hatred of transgender people, but the transgender rights movement promotes hatred of LGB Alliance because the way I put it is we have committed high treason. We have been disloyal by distancing ourselves from the transgender rights movement, meaning we must be severely punished.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just really strange. I wanted to talk about self-ID for a second, because this is something that is, well, not now, but it used to be a hot topic around 2020, 2021, the infamous Section 33 in Hungary, which is basically a parliament decision amending the Civil Code and Child Protection Act in May 2020, and it's Section 33 mandated recording sex at birth instead of sex in the birth registry, basically making it impossible to change gender on documents, which was allowed between the early 2000s up until 2018, more or less. So transgender people, intersex people could change their gender marker and their name in their official documents. Now this is not allowed. So this was a big, you know, point of advocacy for the local organizations. Now we have practices from other countries already where we can look at and see why this is problematic if we allow self-ID. But what do you think about this? What is your stance on self-ID, or what has been your stance?
It has changed a lot. Well, I always saw it as problematic, but when I started to think about it, and what I noticed historically was what I called an escalation of demands. So the first demand was for change of legal sex after surgery. Second demand was change of legal sex with no medical treatment at all, which the UK government accepted in the Gender Recognition Act 2004, even though no other country in Europe had done it. And that quickly led in 2012 to Argentina's law, the first one on self-identification. So change of legal sex with no conditions at all, no diagnosis of anything. And then the fourth demand comes in 2017 with the second version of the Jakarta Principles. Principle 31 claims that every government in the world must take sex off of birth certificates. Sex must not be recorded. So if they'd stopped at the first demand, perhaps I wouldn't be questioning it today, but they kept pushing until they get to self-identification, taking sex off birth certificates. And that caused me to say, wait a minute. And actually to go back to day one, which for Europe I thought was 1972, when Sweden passed the first law allowing change of legal sex. And so I consider this in my forthcoming book, Transgender Rights versus Women's Rights, From Conflicts to Coexistence, which will be published by Polity Books in May 2025. And I have a chapter called Change of Legal Sex, Should It Be Possible and How Easy Should It Be? And I went back to day one, and this will be a controversial conclusion, but I think actually Sweden made a mistake and they should not have allowed change of legal sex. There was really a fork in the road, so that a transgender person comes to them and says, I face hostility in society because my appearance does not match my documents. So there were two possible solutions. One, to change the documents, or the other, to have strict laws against the hostility. And I think the wrong fork in the road was taken. Because there really was no human rights or other case for changing the document, because the new document is false. Your sex at birth does not change ever in your life. So in the chapter, I adopt a blank slate approach. So what if we're back at the beginning and the majority of countries in the world do not allow change of legal sex? And so I came up with these five options, and the preferred option is don't allow change of legal sex at all. If you have to do it, or if you're already doing it, I think the UK's Gender Recognition Act is as far as any government should go, and it requires a diagnosis of gender dysphoria. So you have to go through a procedure and explain why you need an exception from the general rule that your birth sex is your legal sex for life. But definitely, I don't think there should be any self-identification. It's much, much too easy. It exists in my home province of Alberta in Canada, and there was a report of a man who changed his legal sex so he could get cheaper car insurance because the rate is lower for women. And there's one case in Switzerland where a man changed his legal sex using self-ID to avoid military service.
Right.
And certainly in California for prisons, they have self-ID. It says regardless of anatomy. So you can be born male and have your body intact, no hormones, no surgery, and a woman can find the male person next to her in the prison cell. Yes, no, I'm against self-ID. And maybe here I could just add, there's a saying in English, politics makes for strange bedfellows. So you find yourself in bed with people that you don't feel quite comfortable with. And a very good example of that for me is the question of sports in the US. Mm-hmm. So there's an ongoing case in Connecticut where two male to female transgender teenagers were allowed to compete in girls' track and field, and they won a lot of races. And some of the girls complained. The case is in court, So which NGO is supporting the transgender athletes? The American Civil Liberties Union, which is historically very pro-LGB. And which NGO is supporting the girls? It's Alliance Defending Freedom, a Christian rights organization, which is historically anti-LGB. But on this issue, I agree with the Alliance Defending Freedom and I disagree with the ACLU. And I wish that they would understand that they are wrong in their position. But I've got used to the idea that I'm going to be on the same side as people I don't agree with.
And you're going to hell. Well, not according to Christians now, but...
Yeah, I'm not worried about that. But actually, I read Judith Butler's recent book, Who's Afraid of Gender? And what she does is construct this false choice. She says, basically, either you're on my side, the forces of gender, which means good, or you're on the side of the forces of anti-gender, which means the Vatican and others.
And evil.
And evil, yes. And so if you're not on my side, if you have questions about certain transgender demands, therefore you are also racist against abortion, against equal rights for women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is absolutely ridiculous. Every individual can choose different political positions. Just because you agree with the Vatican on one issue doesn't mean you agree about others. And in this chapter, I talk about the need for a middle political space, which is LGB friendly, but has some concerns about some transgender demands. Whereas at the moment, what we tend to see, especially in the US, either the progressive position, which accepts all transgender demands, or you tend to get an anti-LGBT perspective, which is the one of the Alliance Defending Freedom, or the Hungarian government, etc. So yes, you can agree on some transgender issues, but you disagree on the other issues.
And the usual comeback from the LGBT movement is, you know, who does it hurt? And of course, you already mentioned a couple of examples on who it actually hurts. And women are saying, well, it does hurt us. Sorry, we're not against you, but respect that our sex segregated spaces are there for a reason. We want them. We need them. We please and thank you would like to keep them. And it's just astonishing to me how, you know, big, well-respected organizations, you know, with global reach, Amnesty, all these, ACLU, would just ignore that completely. I mean, the US is proud of, you know, Title IX and all these legal gains that were fought for so hard, you know. And it's just incredible to see, like, how quick the change was over the past couple of years, even though, I mean, you know this better, but yes, there were signs of it and there were preparations, there were these acts in different countries, but there was not such a huge demand for women to give up their spaces or sports being taken over with self-ID, just like that, you know, the Olympics, you see the weightlifter guy posing as a woman. I mean, it's just absurd and ridiculous, and somehow you are unable to argue. And I wonder what your comeback is to this, you know, like, who does it hurt? Why can't you just be nice?
Okay, first of all, it's all happened very quickly. A key moment is June 2015 when the US Supreme Court rules in favor of same-sex marriage in all 50 states. So that battle is over in the US. It had already been won in 2013 in England and Wales and France. So that's when you get this gradual shift, the LGB organizations focusing on transgender issues. I remember the first time being handed an ID badge with a blank for pronouns was at the ILGA Europe Conference in Cyprus in 2016.
ILGA is...
International Lesbian and Gay Association, yes. European region. But now the full name is the European region of the International Lesbian and Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's all happened very recently. Now, why don't more people object to this? Well, my explanation is, first of all, for men, it's a completely hypothetical issue. This is an asymmetrical issue like abortion. If abortion is banned, no man is affected directly. And no man is affected here because if a female-to-male transgender person wants to go into a men-only space, they're welcome. I don't think you see a big demand for female-to-male transgender persons to go into men's prisons, or and in men's sports, they will be at a disadvantage, etc. So there really is no threat to men at all. So that's why it's easy for men to say, who does it hurt? So men have to employ empathy and put themselves in the position of women. But then I start asking myself, well, why do so many women support these demands? Yeah. And it occurred to me, well, because the concrete situations when there's a direct conflict between a transgender person and a woman are sufficiently infrequent that most women haven't experienced them. They need to employ empathy and imagination. So let's take, I'll give at least two concrete examples. One is you're in a communal shower room for women. Next to you is a person with male genitals. Now that can happen, but it probably doesn't happen that often. So the woman who hasn't experienced it can say, oh, well, that's just discomfort. It's like having a black woman standing next to me when it's completely different. Most women will never be in prison, so they don't think about how a woman in prison might be affected. And most women probably not in competitive sports. So there, it's easy to dismiss the rights of women in that context. So even women have to employ empathy and imagine what it's like to be in a woman in that situation. Now, the one thing I noted was that the one example that affects all women is changes in terminology. And this is something that you cannot avoid and not or fail to notice. So if we start talking about pregnant people, so Bette Midler, the singer and actress, tweeted about this. We can't be called mothers anymore. And that was actually probably J.K. Rowling's second big tweet after commenting on Maya Forstater's case. People who menstruate, she said, we used to have a word for this. What was it? Womba, Wimba,
yeah.
Something like that. So that's one example that affects all women. But I think whether you're a man or a woman, you have to imagine these concrete situations. Put yourself in the shoes of the woman who's there and ask yourself, is this right? Is this fair? So I actually, in September 2018, I was at the World Masters Athletics Championships in Malaga in Spain. It's masters means age group. So first age group is 35 to 39, then 40 to 44, goes up to 95 to 99 and 100 and over. So I watched a race, a hurdles race, in which a male to female transgender person participated in the women's category and won a bronze medal. And at the time I thought, this person was by far the tallest in the race. And I thought, well, for the woman who came fourth, was that fair? Fortunately, in sports, things have developed well. So we have Leah Thomas to thank for winning a swimming race in the US and shining a spotlight on this. So
after
that,
a male.
Yeah, born male, who was swimming as a man and then switched to swimming as a woman and suddenly started winning. The real test when people say, oh, there's no advantage, is just compare the person's rankings as a man with their ranking as a woman.
Yeah.
And that's where you see the advantage. And so after that case, World Aquatics changed the rules. If you've gone through male puberty, you cannot participate in women's competitions. And World Athletics or track and field has done the same thing. So at least at the international level, they're finally getting it right.
So crazy. I want to go back to the Yogyakarta. How do you say this?
It's actually, it's pronounced like a J, okay. Yogyakarta.
Yogyakarta principles.
I don't know why they chose that spelling, because it's confusing.
Right. So these principles are a document that was put together 2006, if I'm correct.
2006.
It was a group of lawyers, human rights experts, and activists. And so you participated then, and it's basically a document about human rights in the areas of sexual orientation and gender identity. and it is a list of things that they recommend or say governments should do in order to fight discrimination. Mm. I wasn't actually too aware of how influential these principles are, but apparently they really are. And so they even use them as like, you know, they cite them in courts and big human rights organizations cite them. Even Hungarians, you know, LGBT organizations have it on their websites as, you know, a basis of how to fight discrimination. And it was really interesting to read how you became critical of some of the articles of the principle, exactly because of the demands with regards to gender identity. You mentioned that there was not really a consideration of women's rights or how this might affect women's rights at the time. Was it because everybody just had good intentions and kind of, you know, were not really considering because, well, who would think that, you know, we're fighting against discrimination? It could only be a good thing for everybody. What could go wrong, or how did it go, or how did it change over the years?
Okay, well, the guiding principle of the principles was supposed to be that they were stating what international human rights law already required. So the theory was that there was nothing new in the Jakarta principles.
Okay.
Probably in most cases that's true, but in other cases I say the principles veered off into advocacy. So in effect they were dishonest. They were claiming that this is already the law that everybody should agree on, but they're actually calling for something new. So the test that was applied on the LGB side was basically anything can go in, because the view was that this is a fair interpretation of international human rights law, except something that's been ruled out by the United Nations Human Rights Committee, which is a body that interprets the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Which is similar, it's like the European Convention on Human Rights, except potentially for the whole world. So that was the one constraint, and for that reason, they did not put same-sex marriage in the Jakarta principles, because in a case called Joslin versus New Zealand in 2002, the UN Human Rights Committee said no. Mm-hmm. But by November 2006, when the principles are being drafted, I don't think the UN Human Rights Committee had had any transgender cases. So that meant nothing was ruled out. And the sequence of events was 2002, Christine Goodwin versus United Kingdom. The European Court of Human Rights ruled that the United Kingdom must allow change of legal sex for post-operative transsexuals. That's all, nothing more. And when the transgender groups met with the UK government about the new law, they said, well, actually, we don't want medical treatment as a requirement. And the UK government agreed. So the Gender Recognition Act 2004 was passed with no requirement for medical treatment. Then the Jakarta principles take that and say international human rights law requires this for the entire world.
Wow.
So at the time, it's possible that only the UK had this, at least at the national level, whereas you had five countries with same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage was not included, but change of legal sex without medical treatment was, in principle three. So they were quite bold and ambitious on the transgender side of things. Looking back at principle three, I can see that the problem is really the silence. So it says you cannot require medical treatment, but it doesn't say what other conditions there could be. So that was left open until 2017 and the second version of the Jakarta principles, in which I was not invited to participate. And there in principle 31, you could say they came out of the closet with the transgender advocacy. And they said, well, basically, they said the principle is you must take sex off birth certificates. So it should not be recorded on your birth certificate, your sex at birth, and therefore there's nothing to change. So that's the most convenient situation, you could say, for the transgender person. And they say, until that's done, change of legal sex must be based on self-identification with no conditions at all, in particular, no diagnosis of gender dysphoria or anything like that is allowed. So yeah, I had a gradual waking up starting in 2018, but in 2018, I had been handed a copy of the 2017 Georgia Carter Core Principles. They call them the Georgia Carter Principles Plus 10. The first ones were published in 2007. I was given it in New York, a paper copy. I flew back to London and put it on my bookshelf. I didn't even open it and read them. And 2 years later, 2020, a gender critical woman asked me, have you read Principle 31? I said, no. And then I took a look at it and I was absolutely shocked. I couldn't believe the audacity of claiming that something that no country in the world, to my knowledge, has done was actually an obligation for all countries in the world. I suppose if I had a kind of transition, so to speak, from going along with LGBT to questioning some transgender demands, that was the kind of final confirmation that this movement is really so focused on its own suffering, its own concerns, and not willing to consider the rights of others, that this is really going too far. I mean, I don't think they did any consultations to ask women, do you think this is a good idea if we say you don't really exist? No.
And lastly, I'm really curious about your new book. As you mentioned, it's coming out next spring. And it's called Trans Rights versus Women's Rights?
Transgender Rights versus Women's Rights.
Sorry. Yeah. And it's great to ask you specifically because, yeah, everybody just throws around the word rights all the time. Like, we need our rights, we need our rights. What does it actually mean, you know, conflicting rights? We say, you know, women and transgender people have conflicting rights. I don't know how this actually looks like in a legal sense. You know, transgender people in the advocacy organizations would say, well, the only way to, you know, relieve the suffering of these people is to allow whoever wants to go inside the women's locker rooms and all that. And this should be a human right. And it's ridiculous that we're even questioning this. It's their life, it's their health, it's their well-being that we're talking about. And it's easy, I think, from the outside to look at this as like, well, these are two groups of people, women and trans people and gays, maybe three, that are all, you know, just wanting their rights to be respected. But what are these rights? What rights should we have even? Because we always say, well, this is my human right. But I mean, how is it actually supported with arguments? Basically, I'm just wondering what's your conclusion on this in the book or will you actually...
Well, actually, conflicts of human rights is one of the main themes of the book. There's an NGO in the UK called Transactual, which has a definition of transphobia, and it includes claiming that there are any conflicts between transgender rights and women's rights.
Oh, you're not even allowed to state that there's a conflict.
Yeah. Okay. So some would take the view that the title of my book is transphobic.
Oh, of course.
Because even to suggest there could be a conflict is transphobic. So that's actually where I start in chapter two, conflicts of human rights. And I explained that they're actually very common and they have to be resolved. For example, same-sex marriage, okay? It exists throughout the United Kingdom. Do you have a right to a same-sex marriage in the Roman Catholic Church? Well, no, you don't. Mm-hmm. You have two rights in conflict, right to be free from sexual orientation discrimination, which applies generally when you go seek services from businesses, profit-making businesses, commercial organizations. But there's an exception for religious organizations. So they are not required to provide you with a marriage. So in that case, when rights conflicts, you usually have to draw a line and say, in this situation, one right prevails over the other. So freedom of religion prevails over the right of the same-sex couple to be married. Same situation, a woman wants to be a priest in the Roman Catholic Church. She says, I have a right to be free from sex discrimination in employment, but there's an exception for religious employment. So this happens all the time. There's nothing unusual about it. It's not transphobic or any kind of phobic. to discuss these conflicts. Chapter 3 is about freedom of expression, the fact that we need to be able to discuss these issues. Chapter 4 is called Common Ground, which is that we actually agree on most issues. Transgender people should be protected against any form of violence, harassment, discrimination in most situations where birth sex is not relevant. And as Chapter 5, as I mentioned, talks about changing your legal sex, should it be possible and how easy it should be. And then the chapters about conflicts are really 6 and 7. 6 is the cases of exceptions, whether your change of legal sex is recognized or not. You have women-only spaces. Women-only spaces, categories, and capacities. That's where, so spaces, prisons, changing rooms, hospital wards, categories, sports, and positive action, where there's underrepresentation of women. Can a male to female transgender person be treated as a woman in that situation? And women-only capacities, so pregnant women or pregnant people. That's what I discussed there. Chapter 7 is about children, protecting children from medical transition. And this is a different kind of conflict of rights. The way I describe it, it's two different views of the best interests of the child. So one view is that the child says that he or she wants medical treatment, and the healthcare professionals say, yes, you must have the treatment. They tell the parents, you must consent to this treatment or the child will commit suicide. So that's one view of the best interest of the child based on the short-term or short-term relief of mental distress combined with exaggerated risk of suicide, versus another view is the long-term best interest of the child is for the child not to make any decisions about the child's body until they're 18. And not to use puberty blockers, obstetric hormones, or have any surgery. And I think the arguments there, I conclude, come down on the side of postponing any kind of medical treatment. That issue is before the U.S. Supreme Court now. There are 24 U.S. states that prohibit some or all forms of medical treatment for under 18s. The law in Tennessee has been challenged. The hearing is on the 4th of December, and the judgment will probably come out in June next year. And I think it is probable that the court will conclude that the law is constitutional, especially in an area where there's a lot of debate about the benefits and harms of this this treatment. And I think after they do that, more states are likely to adopt these laws. Mm. We're seeing a trend in Europe where puberty blockers are no longer being routinely prescribed in Finland, Sweden, United Kingdom, etc. So there's a start of a trend against this medical treatment. So really to protect children. And this is where a political conflict arises within the LGBT political coalition. So transgender says, these are transgender children, they know who they are, their mental distress must be alleviated by giving them medical treatment right away. But you could say, before they have a chance to change their minds. And in the past, before this medical treatment was made available, most of them did change their minds. That's what the data showed. So in fact, most of them would decide, no, in fact, I'm a girl. I'm not a boy, I'm lesbian. Or I'm a boy, in fact, I'm not a woman, I'm gay. So the question is whether you should allow young people, just leave them alone, let them grow up, and they might, and actually the past data show that they're more likely to end up as happy lesbian and gay adults. Or do you rush them into medical, to put them on the medical pathway that will change their bodies permanently? So many LGBT adults are saying, no, leave the children alone. And on the transgender side, they're saying, yes, let's get the children on puberty blockers right away. Yeah, that's a debate that's going to continue. But I think the trend, long-term trend, is going to be to ban this medical treatment for under 18s across Europe and across the US.
That would be great. I mean, the whole trans kid idea is, it's a constructed phenomenon. It's so incredible. I mean, even in Hungary a couple of years ago, nobody would say things like this, like there's a trans child. Actually, I think they said the opposite. They said, no, this is not a thing. It's only, you know, we're only talking about adults. And now over a couple of years, it's swept into the discussion. And now, yeah, of course, well, if it's their true identity, and it's just such a weird approach, we would not recommend, you know, unnecessary interventions medically in anyone.
Yeah. Well, what was decisive for me when I thought about it was that the healthcare professionals don't know which children will change their minds.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's all about preserving the child's opportunity to change their mind. And for some, that will mean their treatment is postponed, which they will want to have eventually. But I think the only way to know that you need to change your body is to go through puberty, the only puberty you'll ever have, and experience your post-puberty adult body, and then decide, I need to change it. Until you've experienced that body, how can you possibly know?
Exactly. And not to mention the fact that the transgender movement just, you know, ignores this fact that you mentioned, that most of these gender dysphoric kids or gender non-conforming kids are just gay. I mean, that's incredible. They just would not talk about this at all. Again, there's a fork in the road. It's harder to change society and, you know, change the minds of parents who would not maybe accept their child to be gay. So it's easier just to, you know, send them on a gender clinic, which is just incredible that this could be an argument.
Well, I mean, sometimes it's said that a very progressive position and a very conservative position can actually be the same. They can agree with each other. And this is where we find the very progressive position is in favor of medical treatment. And so is the very conservative one, which you'll find in Iran. So that is where, if you're a woman and you say, I'd like to have a relationship with a woman, they say, great, we need to book your surgery. And same for a man who wants to have a relationship with a man. So I think that should give people pause, progressives. If they're on the same page as Iran, maybe there's something wrong.
Yeah, that's food for thought. Robert, last words, if you have any message to Hungarian listeners about Hungary as you see it, or the Hungarian situation in regards to this topic, or anything else, what can we take away from whatever the legislation and all these decades of work have taught you?
Well, Hungary is a very interesting case for my, and I mentioned it in chapter 5 of my book, because I did conclude that I think the best option, especially for countries around the world that haven't considered this issue yet, is not to allow change of legal sex. And then I have to ask myself, okay, well, Hungary and Russia now prohibit change of legal sex. Does that mean I agree with them? And so what I had to clarify was that no change of legal sex has to be accompanied by strong protection for transgender people against violence, harassment, discrimination. And I don't know, but that's what might be missing in the Hungarian context. So in theory, in isolation, I agree with Hungarian law, but I imagine that there is a lot missing. This is part of building the middle political space, saying Hungary needs 100% LGBT equality with same-sex marriage and full adoption rights and access to donor insemination, etc. But the law on change of legal sex actually can be justified as long as there are strong protections, other protections for transgender people. I think my conclusion in the book, I argue that really transgender people should drop the demand that other people validate their gender identity. This includes changing documents, this includes entry into women's prisons, women's sports, etc. But in exchange for that, society needs to be much more accepting of differences in appearance and clothing. So the fact that a person has a one birth sex, and which is their legal sex, does not determine in any way how they present to the world. And that's what we need to get more used to.
Thank you so much for talking to me, Robert.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.